We have different people that have studied different things that can talk about and show us some other things. And so what I wanted to do today, you know, if you go into like a smorgasbord or even some of the other restaurants, a lot of times they have a salad bar. And so you can go in a salad bar, you can kind of pick out things. You know, you can have olives if you want it, or, you know, carrots if you want, different things on your salad. So I was wanting to just give you guys a little bit of a salad bar situation, and then John will come along and give you the steak and potatoes later on. But I've been in the church 42 years. I was in the Glendale, California congregation, which was a satellite of Pasadena. I gave my first sermonette 30 years ago. I mean, no, 9 years ago when I was 30. Yeah. When I was 30 years old, I gave my first sermonette. Yeah, it was a little more than 9 years ago, wasn't it? Yeah, okay. Anyway, I still feel 39. I just got a 66-year-old body. That's all. In the Pasadena area, there were about 3,000 brethren at the time, and one of them was Reginald. And when did you come?
69 to
72. So he and I were there, coincidence, 69. And one thing about the headquarters there with 3,000 people, there was a lot of what they call brainstorming of the upper level people, right? But some would kind of trickle down. So we heard some interesting speculation of things and actually checked out some things. And, you know, what it says, prove all things and hold fast to that which is good. So I had a chance to learn a lot of things over those 7 years there, and then over the 42 years in the church to prove some of them out. And so what I like to do, like I say, is throw out some salad, some vegetable pieces out there for a salad to you. And if you would like to talk more about these, you know, afterwards, or if you'd like me to speak more in depth of some of these things, I'd be glad to do that. And, you know, take more time in developing. You know, I'm still learning. And one of the most interesting things that came to me in the last, was told to me by, I think it was in Joe Kovac's book, Shocked by the Bible, but one of the brethren mentioned it, which we already know. Who's the God of the Old Testament? Well, we've known it was Jesus Christ, right? That's part of our basic understanding. But I never thought to put it the way it was put here. The God of the Old Testament, which the world thinks is God the Father, the God of the Old Testament was Jesus Christ. Because Christ came and said, no man has seen the Father, and he came to reveal the Father. So guess what? The God of the New Testament is God the Father. He said, pray to God the Father, right? So, like everything else that the world has backwards, you know, and I'd never thought about it that way. The God of the Old Testament is Jesus Christ. The God of the New Testament is the Father. Anyway, that's what my English teacher in high school would call a juicy bit, tidbit. Next thing, that's a carrot or something. How about an olive? I learned recently, I'm still learning yet after 42 years, and within the last year, it was pointed out to me that there was a fourth word for love in Greek. I don't know if I mentioned this before or not. How many of you know about the word agape and then the word philia, right? Agape is the highest form of love. The keeping of God's commandments is agape. Philia is brotherly love. And then there's a non-biblical word that's in the Greek, eros, which is sexual love. But I thought there were only those three. And it was pointed out to me there's a fourth word in the Greek. It's used in the scripture. It's storge. You might want to write this down. English is spelled S-T-O-R-G-A-Y, storge. And amazing that this has been hidden, at least from my understanding and from most everybody else, all these years, because it's wonderful. But the word storge is never used by itself. And if we were to look in Romans 12, first verse of Romans 12, it's used two different places, but it's in compound. Romans 12, and I didn't do that right. It's not Romans 12:1. Okay, it's Romans 12:10. I got 01 instead of 10 when I typed it out. Yeah, dyslexic. Romans 12 verse 10 says, "Be kindly affectioned one to another, with brotherly love. But if you were to look up in Strong's that word affection, which says be kindly affectioned, you'll find out that that word is philio storge. It's a double word or a compound word. Philio is friendly, brotherly love. Like, we can be all friends here, but we can have friends out in the world, right? Friendly love, which we knew about, philio, and where we get the word Philadelphia. But the word storge is love of your kin folk. Now, Linda has January 7th, she's come into having a grandson, born January 7th, and we were at the hospital and saw that, and the grandson's doing fine. And, of course, kind of special in Linda's heart, and she's got to go by there and visit, at least once a week and see, get her grandma fixed. So that's a love of kinship. But the scriptures here say we should have toward each other friendly family love. Isn't that awesome? And we know that our boss and Savior Jesus Christ, he said in Mark 3:31 and also in Luke, I didn't write it down. Now let's go look at Mark 3:31. Mark 3 and verse 31. Then came his brethren. Now, you have to realize this is when the house is all full and people can't get in. So then came his brethren and his mother, and standing without, sent unto him, calling him. And the multitudes sat about him, and they said unto him, behold, your mother and your brethren without seek for you. Verse 33 of Mark 3. And he answered them, saying, who is my mother or my brethren? And he looked round about on them which sat about him, and he said, behold, my mother and my brethren. He looked around about all the people that were there listening to him, and he said, behold, my mother and my brethren. Okay. And then verse 35, he said, whosoever shall do the will of God, the same is my brother and my sister and my mother. This is what Paul is saying. We should be kindly affectioned. We should have friendly, family, kinship, love, one toward another, in the kinship of God's Spirit, and planning to be born into the very family of God and be very brothers. Do we really get that in our mind? That those who will be in the first resurrection are going to be closer. For 1,000 years, we're going to be brothers in God. And really see what Jesus Christ was saying. And that doesn't mean we forget about our physical relatives, because Jesus Christ was concerned about James, Joseph, Simon, and Judas, and his sisters too. At one point, he talked about them. But we should have this very close love. And you know, there's the old saying, blood is thicker than water. That ought not to be in the church of God. The water of baptism, of true baptism, ought to be more important than our own physical bloodline, because we're all going to be the sons of God. And I know that's some of the things that it's hard to get out of the flesh understanding. It doesn't mean we don't love our own physical families, but we have to have a love as great or greater than that, even for God's people and what we're going to be for 1,000 years before some of them come up out of the grave. That was more than a carrot, wasn't it? But I got a little time left yet. The John brought this thing. I was going to mention about the Septuagint. Garner Tad used to have this joke he used to tell about this little old lady that he talked with, and he would talk about what the Greek and the Hebrew really said in the Scripture. And this little old lady would say, well, if the King James was good enough for Jesus, it was good enough for me. And so John brought this in. He mentioned that he had it, and this is the 1611 edition of the King James. This was the very first edition, and it was translated under the auspices of King James, the head of the church, and he's the Pope now instead of the Pope, right? King James. So it does have some Catholic government in it, but Catholic type government in it, bishops and that. But anyway, it was also interesting because this is the first time I've realized this. I've heard a lot of people say there wasn't a J, so it couldn't have been Jehovah, the old name. It's Yahweh or something like that. And the Greek is Jesus. Now, it's not Jesus, it's Jesus. And in the 1611, it's I-E-S-U-S, Jesus. So, but in that regard, as far as what a lot of the sacred namers use, I have no problem in being Jesus was what he was named, because, you see, unlike this King James, that's 400 years right now, this year, isn't it? 400 years out of 2,000 years. 400 years this has been around. Before that, I don't know how many of you are aware of it, but a guy named William Tyndale, before this, was responsible for this and for English being all over the world. Because before that, this translation, you were not allowed. Nobody was allowed by the ecclesiastical powers to translate Hebrew or Greek or Latin. The Old Testament had been translated into Latin, and so had the Greek. Nobody was allowed to translate it into vulgar English. That would contaminate it. And so what that really did was just the priests could read it, and they would tell you what it said. And they told you a lot of stuff that it did not say. And that's why we have a lot of stuff today. And a lot, you know, the biggest evident church now, if you ask many of those people, they say, we don't read the Bible. You know, the Pope reads the Bible. But anyway, I digress a little bit, but the brethren, the Sabbath-keeping brethren that came out of the Soviet Union said that their worst persecutors over there, they were reading Bibles in homes, and would be the Catholics and the Orthodox, because they'd come throw rocks at the door and say, you get us in trouble, you're reading the Bible, the Pope reads the Bible, you don't need to be reading it. Because they allowed the Catholics in under the Soviet Union. Anyway, I digress there. But we could say, you know, if someone was walking 100 years after Jesus, 200 years, you could say, if it was good enough for Jesus, it was good enough for me. Because, you see, the Septuagint was translated by Jews, for Jews, and for people that wanted to read the Bible all over the world, it was translated 300 years, 250 or 300 years before Christ. So the whole world is reading, and the Greek is the language now of the educated. If you were educated in Jesus' day, you knew Greek. And we have, you probably know, that Pilate wrote over the stake Jesus' accusation. This is Jesus, King of the Jews. He wrote in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. Why did he write in Hebrew? Obviously, he's in Jerusalem, right? And not everybody in Jerusalem spoke Hebrew. Most of them were speaking Latin, Koine Latin, street Greek. They were speaking Koine Greek. So he wrote in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. Hebrew because it's Jerusalem. Latin because the Romans were the occupiers. Why Greek? Because the whole world for 300 years has been reading, well, actually before that, before the Septuagint, they were reading Greek. So the northern 10 tribes over in the east, most likely to them, the Greek Septuagint, that's the name of the Old Testament in Greek, was like our King James today. It was considered the excellent translation done by the Jews for Jews. So the whole world's reading that. And one morning I woke up and I said, what's the name of the book of Joshua in the Septuagint, which has been read for 250, 300 years? And it's Jesus. So I got no problem when the angel came to Mary and said, name him Jesus. Plus, they already learned a lesson from John the Baptist's father, right? You know that lesson, right? They said, name him John. And he said, well, how do I know we're going to have a baby? And he said, because you won't speak until you name him John. So, anyway, I have no problem that they named him Jesus. And I had not heard that put forward because, you know, the main topic is that that Joseph and Mary were Hebrew, so they would have named him a Hebrew name. But, again, all the world, including many in Jerusalem, were reading the Old Testament in Greek. So, let's see, that was a little lettuce, I guess, the main body. But anyway, if you want to discuss any other of these things, I'd always enjoy it. And another item I want to bring up, I've found interesting. A lot of times, you know, we have Passover and unleavened bread, and I don't know if we always pick up on exactly the image there. Because think about the Israelites in Egypt at the Passover. They're sitting there, right? And they're hearing screams and everything going on. People are dying. But they're just sitting there. They're not doing anything. That's picturing Christ dying for us. We didn't have anything to do with it. Christ died while we were yet... We weren't even born, let alone... While they were yet sinners there, we weren't even born. Passover pictures what Christ did for us. What does unleavened bread picture? Well, the Israelites had to pack up and get out of Egypt, which is a type of sin. So we... Then, after the Passover, which Christ did for us, we have to pack up and get out of sin. We have to feed on the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth, which is God's Word, so we can know the way out of sin, right? Because, you know, we're out, like they're going through the wilderness, we're going through it. And many of us have come through the wilderness, and first thing we maybe learn is the Sabbath, you know, and we start following the Sabbath, and we keep reading, and we find paths through this wilderness of false truth that Satan's put out there. So anyway, I thought that might be interesting to bring up, that I see it as Passover and unleavened bread have two different pictures. Passover, what Christ did for us, unleavened bread for what we need to do, pack up and get out of sin. And I'm getting pretty close to the end of my time here. And another thing, if you want to discuss it sometime or you want me to elaborate on it, in Matthew 27, it's the only place in the Scripture that it's mentioned. See, this way, if I go over a bunch of different topics, if somebody's heard all this stuff already, there might be one thing in there, one thing that you haven't heard about, and I can give you something to keep you awake so you don't sleep while I'm talking. Matthew 27 and verse 50 says, Jesus, when he had cried again with a loud voice, yielded up the should be the spirit. And behold, the veil of the temple was rent in twain from the top to the bottom, and the earth did quake, and the rocks rent. So there's a big earthquake, and the rocks were busted open, and the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints which slept arose. And they came out of their graves after his resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared unto many. So, why? What was this? How does this fit into God's plan? What does this mean? So if you want to discuss this sometime, it's got a very interesting information that's hidden in these two verses here. So I thought, well, today I would do that rather than just have one topic. I would come and throw out a few tidbits out there, give you some salad, and then I don't know if John's got steak or salmon or what he's got planned. But.
The old question is, should I or shouldn't I? I got a song that I think I'll do. I'm going to try to do it. Put it this way. I'm going to try to do it. I hope it won't be too far over the top for any of you who are a little more conservative. I've been working on this, trying to fine-tune it for a couple of years, but I figure if I don't do it, I'll never do it. So if I mess it up, well, what can I say? But we'll see how it goes.
As we look around the world. today. Earthquakes, war, and famine on the way. Jesus will be coming, that there is no doubt. When all these things are happening, lift up your head and shout. I got a feeling in my body, Jesus Christ is on his way. Hey. And I believe the signs are saying it won't be long until that day. The sun will turn to darkness, the moon will turn to blood, then the sky will be rolled back with freedom from above. I got a feeling in my body, Jesus Christ is on his way. And we'll be changing into spirit when the trumpet sounds that day. Won't you lift your eyes up, children, lift them to the sky. The kingdom stands before you, the gates are open wide. Shelter for the weary, comfort for the weak. Leave the devil's evil lying in defeat. I got a feeling in my body, Jesus Christ is on his way. And I believe the signs are saying it won't be long until that day. Earthquakes, war, famine, pestilence, plagues, storms, false prophets, tribulation, martyrdom, abomination of desolation, stars fall from heaven, it won't be long, he's on his way. Won't you lift your eyes up, children, lift them to the sky. The kingdom stands before you, the gates are open wide. Shelter for the weary, a comfort for the weak. Leave the devil's evil lying in defeat. I got a feeling in my body, Jesus Christ is on his way. And I believe the signs are saying it won't be long until that day. Well, I got a feeling. Are you believing? Are you believing? I got a feeling. I'm believing. I believe the signs are saying Jesus Christ is on his way. And we'll be changing into spirit when the trumpet sounds that day. When thy kingdom comes.
Hope that wasn't too much. Okay. Well, unless you've been asleep for a couple of weeks and you missed the update, then I'm sure all of you are aware of the news in the Middle East and the Mediterranean area. Many are wondering, what does it mean? The current U.S. administration, along with most of the world, is seemingly unaware that they are playing right into the enemy's hand and helping to bring about the formation of the King of the South. They don't have a clue. You just listen to one reporter after the next from this country and that country, and they're all so excited. This is the greatest thing that is happening in Egypt, and it has already happened in a couple of other countries, and is spreading. But as we all know, God is in control. So this may be a part of his plan to ease us into the time of the end. Daniel 11, and verse 40 is where I want to begin today. Daniel 11 and verse 40. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, with many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. So, who is this king of the south? That's what everybody wants to know. Who is this king of the south? Well, let's keep your place there. Take a little trip back to Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 41 and verse 21. It says, present your case, says the Lord. Bring forth your strong reasons, says the king of Jacob. Let them bring forth and show us what will happen. Let them show the former things what they were, that we may consider them, and know the latter end of them, or declare to us things to come. So show us the former things. Who was the king of the south, so we can know the latter end, who will be the king of the south. So Daniel 11 and verse 1. Also in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. This is the angel that is talking with Daniel, giving him this prophecy. So this prophecy comes right from an angel. And Daniel is listening to it, and eventually he writes it all down and has it for us. And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others besides these. Also, the king of the south shall become strong as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. At the end of some years, they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of her authority, and neither he nor his authority shall stand. But she shall be given up with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in these times. And you're wondering, what? It's a little confusing, right? Well, I'm going to explain this. But from a branch of her roots shall arise in his place, who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them, and prevail, and shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt, with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So, the king of the south comes up to the king of the north, and captures their gods and gold and whatnot, and takes them where he's from, which is Egypt. Egypt is the king of the south. So, of ancient history. So what follows throughout the remainder of this chapter are the wars between the king of the south and the king of the north, all the way up to the end time. And all of this was prophesied hundreds of years before it happened. So this is where we're at. Now, what I want to read from Haley's Bible Handbook, where he will explain these verses, so you'll get an idea from history as to what this was and what he's talking about. The Greek Empire, with its four divisions, 331 to 146 B.C., the wars of Syrian and Egyptian Greek kings, 323 to 146 B.C. Verse 3 is the mighty king, which was Alexander the Great, the fourfold divisions of his kingdom, Greece, Asia Minor, Syria, and Egypt. The king of the south, Ptolemy I of Egypt, one of his princes, originally was an officer under Ptolemy I, became king of Syria, most powerful of Alexander's successors. Verse 6, the daughter was Bernice, the daughter of Ptolemy II, was given in marriage to Antiochus II and was murdered. A shoot from her roots, Ptolemy III, brother of Bernice, in retaliation invaded Syria and won a great victory. Verse 8. So that from history tells you who this girl was and who that person was and the shoots and the roots and all that. That's where that's all coming from. So also, up to this time, the great powers of the world had been in Asia and Africa, but looming ominously on the western horizon was the rising power of Greece. Alexander the Great, 336 BC, at the age of 20, assumed command of the Greek army and, like a meteor, swept eastward over the lands that had been under the dominion of Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, and Persia. By 331 BC, the whole world lay at his feet. On his invasion of Palestine in 332 BC, he showed great consideration to the Jews, spared Jerusalem, and offered immunities to the Jews to settle in Alexandria. He established Greek cities all over his conquered domains, and along with them, Greek culture and the Greek language. And after a brief reign, he died in 323 BC. On Alexander's death, his empire fell to his four generals, the two eastern sections going Syria to Seleucus, Egypt to Ptolemy, Palestine lying between Syria and Egypt, first went to Syria but shortly passed to Egypt and remained under control of Egypt until 198 BC. Under the kings of Egypt, called the Ptolemies, the condition of the Jews was mainly peaceful and happy. Those that were in Egypt built synagogues in all their settlements. Alexandria became an influential center of Judaism. So the king of the south was Egypt. And the king of the north was Syria. But the rest of the empire was Asia Minor and Greece. So you have to take it all into consideration as things ebb and flow. So today, Egypt is Egypt on the south of the Mediterranean Sea. Greece is on the north of the Mediterranean Sea and is part of Europe. One of the kings of the north was Antiochus Epiphanes, probably the most famous. Daniel chapter 11, and verse 31. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress, and they shall take away the daily sacrifices, and place there the abomination of desolation. So here you have the sacrifices being taken away, the abomination of desolation set up by Antiochus Epiphanes, who is a type of the end time beast. So when you read this in here, you're even going to see a description that he does exactly what the beast does at the end time. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the city who understand shall instruct many. Yet for many days I shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. And some of those of understanding shall fall, to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. Then the king, this is the king of the north, shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. For what has been determined shall be done. So remember that description of this king of the north. This was, in history, Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes, 175 to 164 BC, was violently bitter against the Jews. He made a furious and determined effort to exterminate them and their religion. He devastated Jerusalem, 168 BC, defiled the temple, offered a sow on its altar, erected an altar to Jupiter, prohibited temple worship, forbade circumcision on pain of death, sold thousands of Jewish families into slavery, destroyed all copies of Scripture that could be found, and slaughtered everyone discovered in possession of such copies, and resorted to every conceivable torture to force Jews to renounce the religion. This led to the Maccabean Revolt, one of the most heroic feats in history. You've all heard of the books of the First and Second Maccabees, and that's what that is. We don't include it in the Bible, but as a historical document, you want to read about the wars of the Maccabeans in this time against Antiochus Epiphanes back at 168 B.C. You see what they went through. And, of course, this all led to, I believe, the Feast of Dedication. This is one of the reasons why the Septuagint came in to such prominence at the time of Christ. Because 150 years before that, Antiochus Epiphanes destroyed all of the copies of the Hebrew Scriptures in Jerusalem and surrounding areas and killed anybody he found that had a copy. So when they had to replace these, the Jews coming up from Egypt, where the Septuagint was put together, had the copies. And so naturally, the natural use of things is they brought it up and it replaced the Hebrew Scriptures of the day. And of course, there were still Hebrew Scriptures to be found. I'm sure he didn't destroy all of them. But that's why a lot of them are hidden. You hear about the Dead Sea Scrolls, where a lot of these things were hidden in caves and stuff, so he wouldn't destroy them. It gives you a little idea of the things that went on back at that time. So, let's go back to Daniel chapter 8, because Daniel chapter 8 deals with Antiochus Epiphanes, who is the king of the north. Then we'll get back to the king of the south. Daniel chapter 8 and in verse 8, just so you understand what the historical setting for all these things. Therefore, the male goat grew very great, but when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in his place four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. So this is talking about Greece. It's talking about Alexander the Great dying and the four generals taking over. And out of one of them came a little horn, which was Antiochus Epiphanes, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. And it grew up to the host of heaven and cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. Now, you have to understand that when you read through Daniel 11, when you get to the character of Antiochus Epiphanes, it never changes all the way to the end. So this is such a type of the end time beast that some of these things that are talking about is what happens at the end time by his antitype. So he exalts himself even as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifice, and he cast truth to the ground. He did all this and prospered. So Antiochus Epiphanes was a type of the end time beast. And just so we don't have to guess, in verse 22, as he says in verse 21, he hears a voice that says, Gabriel, make this man understand. So the angel Gabriel is telling Daniel what this is and what he's seeing in this vision, what it means. And in verse 20, he says, the ram which you saw having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia, and the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn as between his eyes is the first king, which everyone knows is Alexander the Great. As for the broken horn, the four that stood up in his place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. So it went to his four generals. It was naturally weakened. It wasn't the same as it was under Alexander. And so the angel is explaining this to Daniel. Now, as I told you, remember that description of the king of the north, because Revelation 13 uses the same language. Revelation 13 and verse 5. And he was given a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. And also in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, same description. Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. So this end time fulfillment of the type of Antiochus Epiphanes, this end time beast, will head 10 nations. Again, in Revelation 13 and verse 1. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. And then in verse 17, it gives us some further information. Chapter 17 and verse 3. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. So the beast is carrying the woman. The woman is sitting on the beast. Verse 7. But the angel said to me, why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the 7 heads and 10 horns. Well, who is the woman? Verse 18 tells us. The woman which you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. So, the woman is the city. The city is sitting on the empire, the beast. So, now, the beast is, verse 11, the beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth and is of the 7 and is going to perdition, the son of perdition, which we just read about. Now, the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings. So we don't have to guess what it means, what it is. The Bible tells us the 10 horns are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. So there's coming a time for a short period when these 10 leaders are going to unite and give their power and their authority to the beast so the beast can do what the beast wants to do. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast, and as the end result, these will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. So, using the biblical example, if the end time king of the north is the head of some combination of 10 nations or leaders of Europe, because that's where the king of the north is in Europe. Anciently, it was Greece and the upper area of the northern part of the Mediterranean Sea was the king of the north. The southern part was the king of the south. So if the king of the north is the head of some combination of 10 nations or leaders of Europe, then the king of the south will also be the leaders of some combination of nations on the southern and eastern Mediterranean Sea, which is why we see the unrest in many nations in the region today, not just Egypt. What we're seeing is Bible prophecy being fulfilled. It is beginning. That's what we're seeing. This isn't a good thing for the world. For us, you know, unfortunately, we got to go through it to get where we're going. But I want to read to you now something from the grave. This is a letter from Garner Ted Armstrong, 9 years ago. This is, well, it's from the website. Everybody had this 9 years ago. I haven't heard anybody mention it lately. So, from Chris Cumming and the website office staff, transcript of a portion of Garner Tetz Armstrong's sermon called "The Culmination of Prophecy," given April 13th, 2002. So this is what he said at the end of the sermon, and they put it in writing for us so we could have it. He says, "I want to go to give you now in summary some things that really will, in a nutshell, show you what to look for in the immediate future in the months, year or two, just ahead of us now." Ahead of us now, not ahead of then. See, he was always ahead of his time. So, what we're looking at right here is what's ahead of us just now. Look for a charismatic Arab leader who will attempt to bring Arab nations under one green flag of Islam, who will become the king of the South of prophecy. And that's what we're seeing the beginnings of right now. Look for the creation of a multinational all-European army or rapid deployment force capable of immediately launching an occupation of Palestine. Because, as we will read in a few minutes, that's where the King of the North goes. Look for the intervention of a great false prophet who will give his blessing to the creating of a united Europe and its advance into Palestine. And that is the woman that we just read about, who rules over the kings of the earth. Look for the building of a temple, or the erection of a temporary structure, and the dedication of a cornerstone, the institution of priests and sacrifices in Jerusalem, which we've mentioned many times to be looking for. Look for some major catastrophe to strike Israel, which will either cause the government to approve the destruction of the Arab mosque or a coup by the Israeli military to accomplish the same thing. Basically, what he's saying is when the Jews get to that point, you know, and Garner Tetz has mentioned it before when he interviewed some of the leaders in the years gone by of Israel, when they were surrounded by armies back in 67, 68, 70, 72, 73, and they got the bomb. They said, "Before we go back into slavery, we will bring down the temple of humanity," meaning they're going to push the button if it comes to it. And this is what they're talking about when it comes to push comes to shove. And Israel decides they better get back to God completely. They're going to destroy the Arab mosque and all the stuff that has to do with it. So that's what they feel will happen. Now, whether it will be completely accomplished remains to be seen because of all the everybody screaming this direction or that direction. Who's going to intervene and do what to prevent what? But look for a combined attack of Arab armies against Israel. Watch for skyrocketing energy prices and a global economic meltdown, with Japan as well as Europe and the United States plunging into a global Great Depression. Look for the emergence of dictators and kings to take over chaotic governments mired in depression, civil unrest, race wars, and anarchy. Just like in Egypt, they think they're going to have a democracy. It's not going to happen. Before they ever get there, or if they do get there, it won't last, and you're going to have the terrorists are going to end up forcing their hand. Continue to watch for major attacks against the West from terrorists. Expect in the future major persecutions of God's people. Look for this King of the South to push at the beast power of Europe, such as oil embargo, which will result in immediate military occupation of the Middle East, including the sources of oil. Look for the possibility of the invasion of Israel by the beast power this time in an attempt to save the remaining Jews alive as a peacekeeping gesture rather than to occupy it as if an enemy. Watch for increasing earthquakes in diverse places, disease epidemics, regional wars around the world. And finally, of course, look for the eventual time when the work of God is going to be put down and out and will be censured and will be unable anymore to shout a witness and a warning. This is the scenario of prophecy that is biblically based, and you can watch for those things all around the world as you have been, I'm sure. So don't cease, and always when you watch your daily news and these things happening, see them in the context of what you know Bible prophecy says is sure to happen. So, with that, back to Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40. At the time of the end, which is just ahead of us, the king of the south shall attack, shall push at, shall butt or gore the king of the north. What does that mean? He's going to push at, he's going to stick it to him. How's he going to do that? I think a lot of people are thinking, because we've lost our sea gates, it'll be the Suez Canal. When they shut down the Suez Canal, the world is going to pay. It will be panic time. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, with many ships, and shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also, in other words, if you remember the term blitzkrieg, he's just going to do it lightning fast. They're not going to sit around and negotiate. They're just going to come at them and take it. Not going to fool around. No negotiation. He shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape from his hand: Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon, which they believe is Turkey and Jordan, that area to the east of Jerusalem and Israel. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over the precious things of Egypt, also the Libyans and the Ethiopians at his heels. In other words, it sounds like not only is he going to go down and take over the Suez Canal, he's going to get rid of the pirates too. They're not going to mess with the oil. But, as he's in the process of doing all that, the news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. So, as he's doing this battle, just like through the whole chapter, the king of the south and the king of the north, as you're going through this battle, when the king of the south does this final push, the end time king of the north, this end time beast power, end time type of Antiochus Epiphanes, comes down with great fury and just takes over. And then he hears news coming from the east, which of course is Russia and China. And what are they getting all upset about? Because they think Europe's going to take over all the oil fields. And so they head for the land of Israel and Jerusalem. And it says he plants the tents of his palace in the glorious holy mountain. In Jerusalem. That's where he puts up, that's where he sets up his camp. That's where he goes. And what happens when he gets there? At that time, what happens? Well, there is no chapter break. At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even to that time. And at that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. Which, of course, takes us to Matthew 24. Since you can't have two times that are exactly the same, it has to be talking about the same time. So in Matthew chapter 24, and verse 15, it says, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let them who is in the housetop not come take anything out of his house. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. And pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on the Sabbath. For then there will be great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened." Now, we know they're going to be shortened for us, but are they going to be shortened for everyone before everyone is destroyed? Because we know we're going to be standing on the sea of glass before it's over. If and when extremists take control of the Suez Canal, oil prices will cripple world economies overnight and will bring war. It's just going to happen. The world, think about how people have been suffering for the last 2 years in this country since we've been paying $3 a gallon for gas. And all of a sudden, it seems like nobody's complaining about it. Like they were 2 years ago. That's all you heard. Everybody's complaining. No, everybody's used to it. Nobody's complaining. Except when you hear what's going on overseas and how they are talking about $6, $7, and $8 a gallon gas in other countries. And the reason that they're paying that is because everything is based on the dollar. And they want to change that. And when they change the dollar is no more the world currency, we're going to be paying that because we got to change our dollars into that currency to buy the oil, which we won't drill in our own backyard. And our economy is going to collapse overnight. Just watch what happens when the king of the South starts flexing its muscles. Many nations in Europe are in big trouble, just like the United States. We've been talking, you know, for months about how bad Greece is, Portugal, Spain, some of the other countries over there. It won't take much to push them into a depression. We depend so much on cheap fuel that if the price goes up much, everything we buy will go up. They're already talking about the prices of food going up. It can no longer absorb all these high oil prices. Everything we buy is going to go up, and then the price is passed along. People on fixed incomes and people out of work will suffer first and most. They only have so much money. They don't have any more, and people out of work don't have any. They're, you know, if they're looking for unemployment if they can qualify. They're going to turn to the government, but the government's broke. Too many people are out of work, not paying into the system to keep the system running. And the problem only gets worse, and soon there will be chaos. Did you hear the news last week when we didn't have services because of the snow? The governor of New Mexico said, we're out of natural gas. Turn down your thermostats, put on your hat and gloves, and try to stay comfortable. Yeah, in the United States. It isn't bad yet. The dominoes are falling. If you can, get your financial house in order. What is taking place and what is about to happen, we have been hearing about and preaching about for years, for decades. It's here. Another piece of the puzzle is falling into place. The actors are trying out for their parts. That's what you see going on in Egypt and Tunisia and in Jordan. You know, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is on his way to Jordan today to speak with the king of Jordan because they've been having the unrest there for the last 2 weeks. And all these other towns, you know, you've heard about Saudi Arabia having the same problem. The king doesn't want to give up his authority. He's afraid this stuff's going to spill over into his country, which is why he wanted Mubarak to stay in power. Because as long as he was there, there was no unrest. And now they think they have rest. But another is coming. So, soon the stage will be set as all these actors get their parts. Soon Christ will walk up to the Father, take the scroll out of his hand, and remove the first seal. The curtain will rise and it will begin. Many see what is happening as a good thing, but they are not looking through the eyes of Bible prophecy. The gospel is a good message, but there is a lot of bad news to be reported. Luke chapter 21. Luke chapter 21 and verse 25. There will be signs in the sun, in the moon, and in the stars, and on the earth distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them from fear and the expectation of those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in cloud with power and great glory. Now, when these things begin to happen, look up. Lift up your heads, because your redemption draws near. Now is not the time to fear. Now is the time to hold your head up high, for your birth is near. The labor pains are beginning. Then he spoke to them a parable. Look at the fig tree and all the trees. When they are already budding, you see and know for yourselves that summer is now near. So you also, when you see these things happening, know that the kingdom of God is near. So when we see these things happening, what does it tell us? When you go out next month and you see the buds on the tree start to swell, you say, oh, spring is here. Summer's just a few months away. That's what he's telling us. When you see these things begin to happen, then know that the kingdom of God is near. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation that sees these things happen will by no means pass till all takes place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and cares of this life, and that day come upon you unexpectedly, for it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. There are people out here who do not have a clue. They're all over the news. Every channel you turn on, every program you watch, they're all discussing what's going on in Egypt, and they think it's the greatest thing that there ever was. Freedom. 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 But do you remember when the Berlin Wall came down? Garnet Armstrong made the comment at the time. The CIA didn't know. The FBI didn't know. The NSA didn't know. The KGB didn't know. It caught everybody by surprise, except the Church of God. Because we've been talking about it for years and years. We knew that the Berlin Wall was going to come down. We knew East and West Germany was going to unite. And we know that Germany is going to be the head of the beast power in Europe, the King of the North. So it's no surprise. This should not be a surprise to us either. But it's going to be a big surprise to the world, because they think, hey, this is wonderful, wonderful. Watch, therefore, and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass, and to stand before the Son of Man. Stay in constant communication with the one in charge. To that, let's look at Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 23. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. When we see these things happening, it's not time to lose hope and say, oh, no, this should be a time of reassurance, of knowing that what you always believed is true as you watch it come to pass. Hold fast to your hope. Let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as a manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. We need each other. We won't always have each other. There are people in the church who would love to have what you have. I hear from them. You are so blessed to have a local church, because they're out somewhere hours from any church or group, and there's no place for them to go. They're stuck at home. Sometimes one or two, sometimes three or four. And they're stuck where they're at. And they get our videos. You know, and they hear our social. You know, and they just think it's so wonderful that we have what we have. And yet, don't take it for granted. Don't take what you have for granted, because it's too precious. And it's not going to last. You know, the time is coming we're not going to be able to meet. We're not going to be able to gather. There's going to be injunctions, laws against us, and we're going to wish we had spent more time with each other. We see the day approaching. It is a little way off, but the signs are saying it won't be long. With a 30-year peace treaty gone with Israel and Egypt, it's gone. There's no guarantee about that peace treaty anymore. Israel knows it, and they're scurrying about trying to figure out what they're going to do now because they're, once again, surrounded by enemies. The treaty is gone. The pretense is they all want a democracy. The reality is what Max has been screaming at me. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 1. But concerning the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I write to you, for you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night, because the world doesn't have a clue. And when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness, so that this day should overtake you as a thief. We are not in darkness. We see the day approaching in the light of Bible prophecy. It won't overtake us as a thief. The formation of the King of the South is underway. All the more we can pray, Thy kingdom come.